Recent events in Washington, D.C. have reacquainted the American public with the term whistleblower, the person who, like a referee, blows the whistle when they observe someone breaking rules or laws. It's not like the term had fallen out of use. It seems like every so often someone steps forward with information they think the public needs to know about. But that gives us a range from Daniel Ellsberg of the Pentagon Papers to Edward Snowden. Allison Stanger gives us a full history, and it is a long one, in the book Whistleblowers, Honesty in America, From Washington to Trump. Allison Stanger is a professor of international politics and economics at Middlebury College in Vermont. She's also a New America Cybersecurity Fellow. Her previous book is One Nation Under Contract. Allison Stanger, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for the invitation, Jeffrey.
Well, I have to believe this book was in the work for a few years, but congratulations on the timing.
Yeah, it's pretty extraordinary. But it really is a long, long slog. I worked on it for 7 years. It just happened to come out at a time where it could provide a context for events unfolding all around us.
Absolutely, and it is very helpful context to have, especially when we understand that we got a really early start with the Navy and the Revolution. What happened?
Absolutely. Well, most people don't realize it, but whistleblowing is a really American thing. It's, as I say, as American as apple pie, and we passed the world's first whistleblower protection law in 1778. That's even before the Constitution was ratified. What happened was the first commander-in-chief of the U.S. Navy, it's a really interesting story, he was removed from his post for using his public office for private gain. What he was essentially doing is he was from Rhode Island, and he would defy General Washington, who would send him to engage the British, say, in Chesapeake Bay, and he would instead take the U.S. Navy to the Bahamas, which served his commercial interests. So he was very much an example of a public official who was using his position to advance his own interests rather than those of the newly United States, and Congress stood adamantly against that. Part of the reason we fought the American Revolution was because we thought that Britain was corrupt, that they had all these ideals about democracy, but they simply didn't apply them to the colonies. And we had to break with Britain in order to establish a new republic where there wouldn't be this sort of corruption.
So rising out of the Essex Hopkins case, that was the name of the Commodore, we got this law in 1978. Did it actually reference whistleblower? Was the term in use then?
No, the term wasn't in use then. That's like a 19th century development. But if you look at the actual language of what they passed, it makes it very clear that government employees or citizens have a duty, an obligation to report wrongdoing when they see it, to serve the public and to keep democracy vibrant.
So we got that first law in 1778. It seems like as you make clear through the book, there have been a bunch of laws since that time, though.
Oh, absolutely. It's an idea that developed throughout American history, and we kind of refine the concept as we move along, because unlike many other countries, we have celebrated dissent right from the beginning. I mean, our revolution was itself an act of defiance. And we celebrate civil disobedience in many regards, too, and civil disobedience has moved the country forward. But whistleblowing is something that develops over time, and as a result, we have this real patchwork quilt of laws that are very difficult to navigate. But it's a robust tradition that is now being copied by other countries. It kind of starts out as an American concept, becomes an Anglo-American concept when the U.K. adopts whistleblower protection laws in 1998, but it's now a European concept because the EU just passed its own landmark whistleblower protection directive just this month.
Now, there's a notable American export.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a concept that really resonates, and the reason it does so is because whistleblowers help keep elites honest. And I don't need to tell you we're living in a world where the people aren't really sure that elites are acting in, you know, the interests of the people rather than enriching themselves.
All right, so the elites acting up is certainly the focus of whistleblower laws, but you do knock down the idea of partisan political motivation on page 2 of the book. Explain that.
Yeah, it's really important because events are whirling at rapid speed, and there's a lot of spin out there. So it's important to keep in mind what a whistleblower actually is. Whistleblowing isn't a partisan thing. It's an American thing. It's rooted in the concept of the rule of law, and it's meant to keep the system itself alive. So we know a whistleblower by the content of what they reveal, and it doesn't matter what their motives are. It doesn't matter what political affiliation they have. What matters is what evidence they bring to light, and we decide what to do with that. But it's very common in dictatorships, for example, for whistleblowing to be seen in a negative light, right? Because the leader defines what the truth is. And the very idea of whistleblowing relies on us thinking for ourselves and making a determination. So it's a very important democratic concept.
Let's get another concept in before we get to a break, and which is the question of how is a whistleblower different from a leaker?
Whistleblowers are different from leakers. All whistleblowers are leakers in that they reveal information that people want to keep hidden, but all leakers are not whistleblowers. So again, this takes us back to what is really being revealed as being the essence of whistleblowing. People leak for all kinds of reasons, and they have done so throughout American history, but this isn't about advancing a political agenda or about trying to win out in a policy dispute. People leak for those sorts of reasons. This is about the system itself and corruption and illegality. That's what whistleblowers reveal. And if you look at one of our most famous whistleblowers, Mark Felt, who was deep throat in the Watergate scandal, he had motives that were not particularly pure. He wanted the number one position. But again, it wasn't important why he was doing it. What was important is the information he shared with the American public, which led to Nixon's resignation.
All right, so Deep Throat and Edward Snowden and some other names you'll recognize in the book as we talk more with Allison Stanger, the author of Whistleblowers, Honesty in America from Washington to Trump. We will talk more about whistleblowers through American history, and obviously it's a long history of whistleblowing and whistleblowing laws. You can join the conversation, 800-838-3760 and jx@jeffnet.org. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Allison Stanger and you in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio, we're talking about the American tradition of honoring the whistleblower, or at least protecting the whistleblower, the person who blows the whistle on people breaking the rules, usually inside government. There are corporate whistleblowers as well. We'll talk about that in a second. Allison Stanger focuses on the government ones in her book, Whistleblowers, Honesty in Washington, From America to Trump. Obviously, the book was written before we got to the use of whistleblower in the Trump White House. You can join the conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Like all speech, can we presume, Allison, the right to blow the whistle is not absolute, that there are parts of government where, or parts of some information where whistleblowing is not protected?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's why the whole circumstances surrounding the intelligence community whistleblower today are so fraught. It's because in national security, we have to keep secrets to keep the country safe. And national security whistleblowers or intelligence community whistleblowers are, by definition, revealing secrets that they think the American people need to know about. But that's a real taboo in the intelligence community, where keeping the country safe involves keeping secrets. There's always a fear that by even revealing an innocuous piece of information, you're providing that missing jigsaw puzzle piece for the puzzle that the enemy is putting together, and you could really undermine American security as a result. So the secrecy is really prized.
I mentioned a moment ago that that there are corporate whistleblowers as well, and apparently you wrote a bunch about corporate whistleblowers, but cut them from the book. Why?
They're so super interesting, and I wrote hundreds and hundreds of pages of carefully polished and sourced prose about them, did wonderful interviews. It gave me great insight into the difference between corporate whistleblowing and whistleblowing in the government realm. I made the decision to make those cuts not because it wasn't fascinating and important, but because I wanted this to be a book that really moved and focused on illuminating the current context. And you can do that by going from the founding to the present and focusing on public servants rather than information in the corporate sector. So I bring that in through the window and also some interesting comparative ways, but it's not a focus of the book, and I have lots of other stuff I can write as a result in a subsequent book. But I'm happy to comment on the differences there if that's of interest to any listeners.
All right. Well, we'll get to that in a bit. I do want to come back to the history again, because we talked about the context in 1778, and this Commodore in charge of the fledgling American Navy was not a spotless guy in a time when people were concerned about corruption because of the concerns about George III and how he treated the colonies. So we get that the Congress passed a law, but how did the whistleblowers themselves make out in the Essex-Hopkins case?
Well, that's where Congress was so extraordinary in protecting the whistleblowers and defending them. Hopkins was a very powerful Rhode Islander who had previously been very much involved in the slave trade. 60 to 90% of the slave trade went through Rhode Island points at that ports at that time. And so he was very powerful in Rhode Island. So when the 10 whistleblowers came forward with their complaint about Hopkins, two of them had the misfortune of being Rhode Island residents, where he was so powerful locally. And so those two of the 10 were thrown in jail. And Congress actually paid their bail and got them out of jail. Congress paid their legal fees. And Congress even, in addition to the whistleblower protection law, which protected future whistleblowers, they also legislated that all the information surrounding the case should be made publicly available, which is why we can tell this story today.
Wow. So let's move ahead in history. We get to the Civil War, and it appears that the whistleblowing that was taking on then was about war profiteering. How rampant was that?
Very rampant. It leads to the first False Claims Acts, because they're designed to prevent private companies from bilking the government, from fraud. So, for example, you have companies like Brooks Brothers, who were making uniforms for the Union Army, and they were making them out of inferior material, so they would disintegrate several days after you put them on. It's actually where the term shoddy comes from. Shoddy refers to this substandard material that they use so they could increase their profit margins at the expense of taxpayers. And so Lincoln was understandably upset about this, and they passed laws to try to make it possible for people who knew something about this kind of fraudulent behavior to come forward, and perhaps even in the event the cases were successful, they prove that there was fraud, they would receive a cut of the financial award.
Allison, did you find a cycle in American history that we'd have an eruption of activity that would require whistleblower protection? New laws get passed, and then they just sort of ebb over time, and then another cycle erupts like that again?
Yeah, I think that's really a good way to characterize it. There's kind of a back-and-forth pendulum on this issue where obviously the powerful will try to do whatever they can to, you know, advance their interests. And what happens is that whistleblowers will expose corruption or expose wrongdoing, and you can see what sort of loopholes that the powerful exploited, and Congress then tries to use laws to plug that gap. So, for example, with the Watergate scandal, the whole inspector general system through which this intelligence community whistleblower complaint rose successfully, that's put in place after Watergate by Congress, because it tried to learn from President Nixon's abuse of power and pass laws that would prevent it from happening again. So we really do have this back and forth. And in the first Gilded Age, for example, you see very similar.
Where'd you go? Allison, we lost you. I don't know if you can hear us.
I hear you.
Okay, there we go. You're back.
Sorry, I'm so sorry.
I'm not sure what happened there, but okay, so we were talking about during the Gilded Age.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Russia.
Yeah, during. You never know what they're going to do.
Yikes. All right, we are on the Jefferson Exchange. Apparently, Allison Stanger is not. I'm not sure what's doing that. Nope, we got no hands on the buttons here. Allison, 321, can you hear us?
Someone like Boss Tweed, who is a Democrat, by the way, so this shows this is not a issue, who is really immensely corrupt in New York City politics, running Tammany Hall, and he winds up being disgraced and dying in jail, because when a whistleblower brings some of his fraudulent behavior to light, the public responds with disdain. Of course public officials shouldn't be using their office to gain financially. And you see him imprisoned and disgraced. It's interesting today because we have rampant corruption in what I would call the second Gilded Age, but you don't have that response from the public yet. We're sort of confused about what is and is not shameful behavior, and the president has obviously helped in, you know, encouraging that confusion. But hopefully that is going to change as people realize that, you know, we don't want foreigners electing our officials. Obviously, Americans should elect them, and we don't want our elites enriching themselves at the expense of ordinary people.
It seems like over time, though, what happens is you do get a redefinition of corruption. Corruption, I mean, all you got to do is move the line, and all of a sudden what was corrupt becomes legal. That does happen from time to time in American history, too, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And again, I would take us back to the founders and this whole idea of the quid pro quo. Was there a quid pro quo or not? Well, the founders really believed that corruption was any use of your office for private gain. That's why they really adopted the Roman principle, whereby any public official would have to divest himself of private holdings, simply because even the appearance of profiting from holding an office that has certain powers was seen to be completely at odds with American democracy. But today we have a situation where, you know, the president hasn't divested himself of any of his private holdings. He announced that he wanted to hold the G7 summit at his own hotel, which obviously would have benefited his brand. But there's confusion about whether that's right or wrong. And that's a real change. It's something that's taken place slowly over time, but I hope we can come to our senses.
Well, let's ask about that particular part, since you're bringing up the whole Trump issue right now, because we're talking to you just a day after he proclaimed the Emoluments Clause of the Constitution, which is not, by the way, an amendment. It's part of the original Constitution, proclaimed something about people going on about the phony Emoluments Clause.
What did he call it? The phony?
The phony
Emoluments. Okay. Well, that's simply amazing because, well, it's of a piece. It's just a masterful attempt to confuse the American people because, you know, the impeachment proceedings can't be unconstitutional. You know, the mechanism is written in the Constitution. Similarly, the Emoluments Clause can't be phony. It's part of the Constitution of the United States. So simply reading the document would set you straight on that. What we could do, though, to help with this confusion is legislate what the Emoluments Clause actually means in the 21st century. If there's so much confusion, there's things that Congress can do to make it really clear what is and is not acceptable. And I'm hopeful that we'll see that in the months ahead.
So through statute, you're saying Congress could define more securely what the emoluments would be as the Constitution puts them out there?
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty clear how the founders intended it. But if there's any kind of confusion as to what it means here and now, you can pass laws that make that very clear.
We are talking to Allison Stanger, professor of international politics and economics at Middlebury College in Vermont. She is the author of a book called Whistleblowers, Honesty in America from Washington to Trump. Purely a happy accident of timing for her that we're talking about whistleblowers again very much at this moment in history as she gives us the history back to 1778 and everything since. You can join the conversation on the exchange, 800-838-3760 by phone. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. We have a caller here who's going to go just by ex-whistleblower. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Oh. Good morning, everyone.
Hi.
Hi.
I am an ex-whistleblower. I'm a Forest Service employee, and I blew the whistle on my district ranger for logging spotted owl groves. I was on national TV. I was protected from being fired by the Government Accountability Project. But the retaliation was just horrible and fierce and nasty.
And what form did the retaliation take?
Harassment, physical beatings by employees, the non-support or participation by the district ranger, need a, shall I go on?
No, I think we get the picture there. So your perception is that you did some good, but you certainly paid a price for it, despite whistleblower protection laws.
That's true. It did protect me from being fired. That was nice, but the like I said, physical assault, sexual harassment, just all kinds of harassment. Everything from denying the uniform allowance, so my uniform got a little tattered looking, and physical assaults, mm-hmm. the sexual harassment. They would poop on my office floor. I have a file 2-inch thick of nasty pictures, threatening notes. It shows pictures of little animals being blown apart by guns and rifles. All kinds of stuff like that, and it was exceptionally common. And I would show it to the district ranger and to his personnel officer, and the district ranger looked up, and it was a different district ranger than the one I blew the whistle on. The one I blew the whistle on was promoted and moved. Mm. Promoted, note.
Right, and, yes.
But the one that they followed with, I'd show him this stuff and he'd laugh in my face.
Do you have any regrets about blowing the whistle?
Something more
despite that?
Something more than the Whistleblower Protection Act. It was really bad, and I have to be moved out. They wouldn't move me out. I asked for a different duty station. They wouldn't do that. The act as itself probably did what it was supposed to do, but the actual behavior of why did the fellow employees do this to me? Well, because they get, a fee for getting the cutout, for getting the logging done.
Mm-hmm.
A work productivity award, which amounted to little more than a kickback.
Mm-hmm. So they got bonuses out of the trees getting cut, you're saying?
You were paid good bonuses, but then I would find a spotted owl, which I was ordered to do, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
Then I find the spotted owl, and then I get these physical assaults and nasty letters and threatening letters and vandalism.
All right. Thank you for sharing this story with us. I don't want to cut you short, but I want Allison to get a chance to get in here because you got some stories of retaliation in the book yourself.
Yeah, no, your story is just typical of every single whistleblower I write about. It's what I would call the paradox of whistleblowing in America. On the one hand, we celebrate our whistleblowers. We have this long history that I've just been speaking about. But at the same time, even though we have these protections in place, when media attention focuses elsewhere, this is exactly what happens. Whistleblowers are retaliated against. Their friends and family are often affected. In your case, you didn't lose your career, but other people lose their jobs. And this is something we could, as a people, do a whole lot better with because it's human nature, I guess, to want to see the status quo as acceptable and go on with business as usual. But as your story illustrates, you're the person who saw that this really was unacceptable and had to change. And you spoke out and spoke truth of power and paid a terrible price for it. This is a pattern that recurs again and again that I write about in my book, and I think we could do a whole lot better.
Well, the idea that whistleblowing is always for the good obviously is challenged by the people who are going to get dinged by the whistleblowing. I mean, and there's a whole chapter in here on the perception of whistleblowing as treason, which also has a long history.
Yeah, I mean, because you've got a power imbalance with whistleblowing, right? Because these are usually people speaking truth to power, and power has all kinds of ways to retaliate, and absolute power tends to corrupt absolutely. So you've got a classic kind of David and Goliath dynamic in these stories of whistleblowers that is quite compelling.
Now, the chapter focuses at first on socialists and communists living in the United States. I mean, was it truly whistleblowing to bust party members for having been active in those parties?
No. I mean, there you see the whole incredible overreaction of the McCarthy years to people who were former members of the Communist Party, perhaps in their youth. I thought that was a really interesting part of our nation's history to explore, because that's where you see this idea emerging that dissent is treason. In other words, if you dissent, you're somehow being un-American.
Mm-hmm.
That's obviously not the case.
All right, much more to explore with Allison Stanger. Her book is called Whistleblowers, Honesty in America from Washington to Trump. It's a conversation you're welcome to join on The Exchange, 800-838-3760 by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. More discussion of whistleblowers with Allison Stanger and you on The Jefferson Exchange in a minute 25. Segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Allison Stanger is our guest, a professor of international politics and economics at Middlebury College in Vermont. Spent 7 years working on a book about whistleblowers through American history. And what do you know? It arrived just in time for us to be talking about a whistleblower in the Trump administration, talking about that famous phone call to Ukraine. The book is called Whistleblowers, Honesty in America from Washington to Trump. It does not include that incident, obviously, because it just arrived in print. You can join the conversation with Allison Stanger at 800-838-3760. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Let's come back to the chapter on treason here. We're talking about people like, well, now Daniel Ellsberg gets in here, the leaker of the Pentagon papers, Mark Felt, who was known as Deep Throat in the Watergate years. I mean, obviously the designation of hero or traitor is very much in the eyes of the beholder.
Yes, yes, it is. And again, you have to look at what it is they're revealing and whether it outweighs the potential national security risk from revealing classified information. In the case of Ellsberg and Felt, I think it clearly did. But again, in the national security arena, this is the most fraught because of the need to keep secrets. In researching whistleblowers, I really wanted to explore all sides of this issue, so I interviewed all the former NSA whistleblowers, including Edward Snowden, but I also talked to the senior leadership of the NSA at the time of the Snowden leaks. And that was a really fascinating experience because you got two narratives there that had very little in common, if anything.
All right, let's go to that point then. I mean, what did Edward Snowden think he was doing to help our society or our government by putting his information out there?
Well, what Edward Snowden really revealed was a dramatic change in the NSA's standard operating procedures with respect to surveillance after 9/11. We were in an emergency situation. We'd been attacked on U.S. soils at the World Trade Center, at the bombing of the Pentagon. And so those measures were arguably justified at the time because we were at war. But then what happened is they slowly became business as usual. They just became standard operating procedures without having any public discussion of whether these were the sort of trade-offs we wanted to make. So Edward Snowden really forced that out into the public, and we had a conversation, and the law has changed as a result. So in that sense, he provided a public service. But again, it's very fraught because, you know, national security whistleblowers aren't protected by statute. There's a Whistleblower Protection Enhancement Act of 2012 that protects all government employees from retaliation except national security employees. And contractors don't receive protection, and Snowden was a contractor at the time he revealed this information. So that's a very, very perilous path for a whistleblower to follow. Some might have said that he should have complained from within, but I think if he would have complained from within, this information would never have seen the light of day, because the man who was NSA Inspector General at the time of the Snowden leaks, George Allard, was removed from his post in 2016 for whistleblower retaliation. So there really is this tendency in the intelligence community to see national security whistleblowing as an insider threat, as something that needs to be addressed internally. And that was what Snowden had to fight against to initiate this public discussion.
It seems like the issue of illegality should be fairly easy to establish, that if what Snowden was reporting on was illegal to report and yet was illegal itself, there would be some level of whistleblower protection, you would assume. I would assume. Let's put it that way. That's the point. I mean, are there things going on? Did Snowden say that there are things going on in the government that were illegal, or just that the interpretation of laws or rules written within laws had gotten rather expansive?
No, I think he was pointing to some practices that were unconstitutional. But, you know, obviously that's not for him to determine. That's for the Supreme Court to determine. But Congress responded to the information he revealed by changing laws, by saying that the Patriot Act was not being appropriately applied. So in that sense, he exposed illegality, which makes him a whistleblower. But to do that, he had to break laws. So that's the kind of perilous road for a national security whistleblower or an intelligence community whistleblower, which is why that we've even seen this complaint see the light of day. Is extraordinary, this recent complaint.
You mentioned the change in circumstances after 9/11, and that is a major theme in the book. I mean, so how fast did some of these secret parts of the government grow? And do we know?
It's exponentially. I mean, we have an enormous national security state in the United States, and it's complicated by the privatization of intelligence. I mean, I think this is something I wrote about in a previous book called One Nation Under Contract, which really looked at the increased use of contracts in all aspects of our foreign policy. And I think that, too, and I write about this in Whistleblowers as well, helps to explain why we're so confused about what corruption is, what the purpose of government is. It has to do with both Democrats and Republicans alike endorsing this idea of outsourcing work to the private sector, government work, at any time it's possible, with the assumption being it's going to be more efficient. It's going to be more cost effective. All of these are assumptions that really can't be borne out by the evidence. But what the unintended consequence has been is that we're confused about what the purpose of government is, because the line between business and government has been blurred by this practice. So that's why you see the revolving door between the private sector, between government and the private sector. 25 years ago, if you left government for the private sector, you could be seen as selling out. Today, it's known as cashing in. You're, mm-hmm. Making money because of your previous government service. But these things really do combine to blur the line between business and government. And that's, I think, a real reason why we have trouble understanding what is wrong with the president's current behavior.
Let's bring in another example here, because you deal with things in the book like the whistleblower on the Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq, a military policeman named Joseph Darby. His fate was not particularly pleasant after his revelations. But there's another name I want to bring in here, Bunny Greenhouse, which may not be a name as well known as the Abu Ghraib situation. What did she blow the whistle on, and what happened to her?
She blew the whistle on waste, fraud, and abuse in Pentagon contracts, and also sort of this insider tendency of the George W. Bush administration making contracts with Halliburton that were enormously profitable, but she found this problematic because of Vice President Cheney's former association with Halliburton. And she flagged a lot of these contracts which weren't being competitively bidded, but were instead being awarded to KBR, which is a subsidiary of Halliburton. Mm-hmm. And she was dismissed. But she persisted in showing some of the improper behavior that she had identified and testified before Congress. And the result was she was retaliated against. She lost her job. She got her job reinstated. sort of like the story we heard from the caller, her fellow employees actually at one point set up a booby trap in her office, so she tripped and hurt her knee. And the end result was that whistleblower protection didn't really work for her, but she did file in the end a Title VII lawsuit for discrimination because she was an African-American woman, and she did win a settlement there. And she currently teaches mathematics at a community college in Northern Virginia. But she's a real example of someone who saw something that was wrong. Everybody around her was insisting that it wasn't, and she would not be silent. And she paid dearly for it. Yet she was arguably serving all of us taxpayers by making these difficult choices.
Before we come back to the current situation in the White House, I want to get to some other recent examples. We talked about Edward Snowden. Let's talk about WikiLeaks. Same category or different?
Well, WikiLeaks is a complicated thing, and I write about it in the book because if you're going to talk about Julian Assange and WikiLeaks and what he represents, you have to talk about at what point in time, because WikiLeaks undergoes a whole evolution. But I argue in the book that WikiLeaks and Julian Assange really weren't whistleblowers for the simple reason that the misconduct that they revealed wasn't on the part of U.S. officials. Those documents that they leaked showed all kinds of corrupt behavior on the part of leaders in the developing world. So they thought they were blowing the whistle on the United States, when in reality, the documents really show misconduct of other sorts all around the world, but not necessarily in the United States. So in my view, Assange was not a whistleblower.
How about Bradley, now Chelsea Manning?
Same thing. Same logic applies. And this gets back to the distinction between a whistleblower and a leaker. Again, you have to really assess the content of what's being revealed. Simply by revealing a bunch of secrets and sharing them with the public and assuming that there's dirty laundry in there is not sufficient to rise the bar of whistleblowing. You really have to have a substantive complaint. And that's part of the reason why this current complaint really hit home, is because it just delineated so clearly what the potential abuses were that needed to be investigated.
So talk about the dawn of realization that people were talking about a whistleblower within the administration, the inspector general for the intelligence community, not taking the case to Congress, et cetera. I mean, this is as your book is about ready to have its release date. So I could just imagine you might have been jumping up and down or something.
Well, no, you know, it's really interesting because if you read my book, what you'll find is I actually wrote the whole last chapter in the past tense about Donald Trump, because the pattern I noticed, given this historical understanding that I brought to bear on the issue, hopefully, is that the intelligence community had been blowing the whistle on Donald Trump ever since his election, that there was this immense alarm that dates back to the involvement of the Trump campaign, their interactions with all these Russian operatives. That is wholly unprecedented. There's been no previous campaign that was actively fraternizing with the enemy. So that set off red alarm bells right from the start for the intelligence community, not because they're partisans, but because it's their job to defend the national security of the United States. And they saw a potential national security threat in that activity. You should know that also that it's... There's something called the two-hop rule, that you can actually get a FISA warrant to spy on, if you want to use Trump's language, somebody if they are two steps removed from an enemy of the United States. So I would be a potential candidate for so-called spying just because I interviewed Edward Snowden. I had contact with someone who's charged under the Espionage Act. By that same logic, though, these Trump campaign officials who are talking with Russian operatives have to be watched, because that's potentially dangerous activity. It has nothing to do with partisan politics, though. It has everything to do with kind of a nonpartisan approach to supporting the democratic system itself and defending the United States of America.
But the trouble with saying that it's removed from partisan politics is the fact that since you can't charge the president with a crime while the president's in office, the only option if you want to take any sort of sanction is really a political process. So even though the whistleblower may have had pure motives and national security concerns, et cetera, and been following the letter of the law, it still ends up dumping into a political process, which I think still ends up resulting in some dings against the reputation of whistleblowers if you're a big Trump fan, for example.
No, exactly. And, you know, that aspect of it is confusing because obviously the revelations are damaging to the president of the United States, and that seems partisan. It seems like that this is somehow a weapon in the hands of his opponents. But it's really important to realize, and I definitely gained this from the work I did for this book, that people in the State Department, people in the FBI, people in the Pentagon are not partisans. Their job, especially in the intelligence community, is to speak the unvarnished truth to power so that politicians can make the right decisions based on real information. We don't want them spinning the information in a partisan way. That's bad for the United States. So the president is identifying them as partisan, but what they're really doing is just upholding a system that's been in place for a long time and has served us well for over 200 years. And that's called the rule of law.
And we do get the full 200 years plus in the book Whistleblowers, Honesty in America from Washington to Trump. Allison Stanger is the author. She's a professor of international politics and economics at Middlebury College in Vermont. Allison, thanks so much for joining us on The Exchange today.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
All right, take care. That will do it for today's Exchange. We're online at jeffexchange.org. You can suggest guests there. Check out our Facebook page, too. Join the discussion on Twitter at Jeff Exchange. If you're listening in the morning, the takeaway is coming up next. Our evening rebroadcast is followed by news from the BBC. Our producers, John Baxter and Angela Decker of JPR News. Student assistant Randy Babbitt is at the controls today. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Please join us next time on the Jefferson Exchange, and have a great day.